Aloha and welcome to Our Homes Ending the Housing Crisis. I'm today's host, Ian Ross. I'm a legislative aide to Senator Stanley Chang, and my background is in public policy and advocacy, where I've worked in a variety of roles for the last 9 years, both at the legislature as well as in grassroots organizing and advocacy. The topic for today's webinar is how Seattle passed social housing. And to help us answer that question, we're joined by two guests, Tiffany McCoy and Camille Gix. Tiffany McCoy is the advocacy director at Real Change and serves as the co-chair for the House Our Neighbors Coalition and the campaign manager for the I-135. She's in charge of overseeing all campaign communications and field efforts during the start of the campaign through to its victory. And Camille Gix is a graduate student at the University of Washington studying social policy analysis and housing studies. She's on the steering committee for I-135, and she helped draft the initiative as well as contribute to the education, research, and communications on the campaign. So please join me in welcoming our two guests. Please take it away.
Thank you, Ian. And yeah, thank you, everyone. Camille is going to share a screen and we'll go through a broad overview of the campaign and how we succeeded in passing social housing. And really do want to make time for questions and discussion. So we'll get started on that. So yeah, just so everyone knows, I'm sure you do, but just to situate ourselves, we are located in Seattle, Washington. We just ran Initiative 135. It was an 18-month effort from drafting the initiative, getting legal input, legal feedback, getting community input and feedback, redrafting, finalizing the initiative, and then doing the signature gathering and get out the vote. So this was a Seattle-only initiative. This wasn't a statewide initiative. We wanted to start locally and see how the idea of social housing, which we'll get into, floated and was perceived by voters. And fortunately, voters in a conservative special election on Valentine's Day after the Super Bowl put social housing on the map in the United States by a 14-point margin. So we are still definitely resting and recovering from that victory, but immediately jumping into implementation of the initiative and the social housing developer. Camille, do you see that? Maybe share and reshare.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay. Is that better?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. That's just some background. And before we jump into this, it's really important to us that we just like also ground ourselves in like some of the material support that we had from the get-go, because we had a lot of like community support and buy-in as a coalition. We didn't only form for creating social housing in Seattle. So just for folks that are all across the nation looking to replicate social housing, which we know Senator Chang has been working on for a very long time and other individuals. So we just want to give the context of us winning in Seattle. So I work full time at Real Change. Real Change is a street newspaper. I don't know if you have one in Hawaii, but basically, it's a low income or a low barrier employment opportunity. We typically serve folks who have been unhoused or are currently unhoused, very low income, veterans, et cetera. So Real Change is a longstanding organization in the community. We sell a street paper, have been in Seattle since 1994. So because of that, we have an advocacy department, which I lead, and we were able to use two full-time staff positions to really launch the effort of a social housing initiative in the city of Seattle. Whereas some campaigns get started, they're fundraising, they're trying to, you know, get that staff time right out the gate. We had that already. And we also had Camille, who, as you heard in the intro, is a work study student, our policy intern, and getting master's degree at the University of Washington. So we also had her able to work with us as well on the campaign. And we already had office space, internet, printing, administration staff, et cetera. So we had a really great grounding to launch this campaign from. And the coalition House Our Neighbors formed prior to Initiative 135. It was actually us as community members who are really involved in mutual aid, who are involved with our unhoused neighbors, stopping the sweeps like state violence against them, and folks that are just deeply rooted in the community that are trying to seek better solutions than state violence for our neighbors. So there was a charter amendment that was cloaked in the idea of compassion. It was called Compassion Seattle. And they were going to do all of these lofty things without any money. But in the weeds of the charter amendment, they were going to enshrine encampment sweeps as a cornerstone of our homelessness policy. And personally, working with vendors who have been swept over and over by the state, I know the harm and trauma that causes. No typical lefty or liberal groups were trying to come out to defeat this charter amendment. So we organized and actually defeated it. We got it kicked off the ballot. And we decided as a coalition to stick together and put forward our vision of what we think Seattle could be. So often on the left, we're reacting. We're trying to maintain those scraps that the government, you know, gives us every session, or just maintaining our levels of service for our most marginalized. But we wanted to take the opportunity to put forward a bold vision that is completely achievable. We just don't do social housing in the United States outside of, you know, Montgomery County, Maryland. So we wanted to put forward that positive vision. So we already, out of the No campaign, had like a steering committee, we had a coalition, we had folks that had already endorsed us, we already had like communications committees and field committees. So we were able just to really like roll that over into this initiative, putting forward social housing. I'll say too, as I kind of hinted at earlier, Real Change is a trusted community voice, specifically on the left, specifically for folks who humanize those who are dehumanized by the system. So gathering signatures, when we would try to get into the technical pitch of social housing, often signature gatherers would defer to, oh, this is put forward by Real Change, and people would often sign the initiative. And then finally, just to really ground this coalition and this effort and how we were able to win, is we as a coalition made a political choice. And we decided, we had this choice. Do we want to spend our time either lobbying current housing authorities to adopt this model of social housing and add it to their portfolio? Do we want to spend our time on city council or the state legislature to try to get them to do it like years down the road while more and more of our neighbors are entering homelessness and being displaced from this city? We didn't want to do that. We didn't want to spend our like precious resources and time doing that. So we decided to go the initiative route, and we do have the power of that in the state of Washington. So we decided, let's put forward our vision. Let's create the governing board that is going to decide how social housing works in the city of Seattle. And let's really do this out in the public arena, so that we're also getting renters and folks that are oppressed communities involved in this effort, and actually to be part of the visionaries of the city, as opposed to having these backroom closed door discussions. I just want to be very, very clear, like while this is the route we went, if y'all in Hawaii or California or Rhode Island or others are able to do this through your state legislature, because you have legislators that are a lot more ahead of those in Washington state, like right on, that would have been super ideal. That's just not where we were at.
Okay, I think, can we skip a slide? Sorry, one second. My computer is frozen. Zach.
Is it really?
The slides are frozen. I don't know why.
Well, while you're working on that, I want to invite all the attendees to feel free to start writing Q&A. We will have some Q&A at the end. So feel free to start lining up some questions that we'll get to in a little bit later. And look at that. As I give us the filler and remind people to ask questions, it looks like the slides are working again.
There you go. Thank you, Ian. All right. Yeah. So Tiffany did a great job at grounding us in kind of the start, where we got to this this whole initiative process. But another really important thing that we want to ground ourselves in before we go into a little bit more of the details of the campaign is the actual definition of social housing and defining this. This was a super key part of the campaign, and we'll get into that more later in this presentation. But I think that when you're proposing a model of housing that is very different from anything done within this country, having a really clear definition of what social housing means was a key part to our campaign and our messaging and our communications. And so our definition that we worked from throughout the campaign and continue to work from throughout implementation and how we've understood social housing, this was Senator Chang was one of the people that we consulted with when we were coming up with this definition. He participated on panels for us during our campaign to help explain this definition. And then when we went on his delegation to Vienna, this was further cemented in our minds as what social housing means in this context. And so that is housing, which has been decommodified and removed from market speculation by making it public forever in perpetuity and available to all people across the income spectrum in order to create cross-class communities.
All right, so getting into the drafting process. As I said, this was an 18-month effort from start to finish, and we spent about four and a half of those months just on drafting. So yeah, we had a lawyer trying to figure out what was permissible legally, what was more gray area, what was absolutely not permissible. We found out quite early, unfortunately, that we could not couple the public developer for social housing with a progressive revenue source. We wanted to do that. Washington State has one of the most regressive tax structures in the entire country. We rely heavily on sales taxes. We do not have income taxes in the state, and we also rely heavily on property taxes. So we wanted to pair this with a progressive revenue source to have an annual fund to draw on to build and acquire housing. But we learned through the drafting process that we couldn't do that. But we were not deterred. That wasn't a deal breaker for us, because public developers in the state of Washington do have bonding authority. And that was critical for us to go forward, as well as the ability to create the governing board. Focusing first on the bonding authority, that's critical, and we'll get into that a bit more later, because we need to be able to bond on future rents just to like have a larger revolving loan fund to continue snatching up properties off the private market. So the ability to bond on those future rents and to take out debt was one key reason we kept going forward with this model, even though we couldn't couple it with a progressive revenue source. The second is the ability for us to completely create the governing structure from scratch. So instead of going through the city council, where the legislative branch and the executive branch would have a tremendous amount of authority over who sits on the board, and as we know across the country, oftentimes that means you're kind of recycling these same people over and over onto the boards and not really coming up with different ideas or different options or different visions. So those were two of the key reasons we still went forward with Initiative 135, in addition to like all of this other rad stuff we were able to put in it, such as a passive house mandate on all new construction and prioritizing union labor for all of the builds as well. So that's the drafting process. We did this on a weekly basis, working with all of these groups that are listed on this PowerPoint right here, from folks who endorsed us on the campaign that we worked on before. We brought in actually a lot of students from UW who were really interested in this. We always want to, as a coalition, have teaching moments and like educational opportunities. We really try to ground ourselves in not being gatekeepers. Like, we should all be learning this together to make this country a better place for everyone. But these are really the folks that worked a lot on the initiative. And yeah, Camille was essential in that drafting and coming up with some of the board structure. And we decided too to have a renter majority board structure. One of the things that would never, ever have happened if we had done it through a legislative process. So yes, we have the first renter, like majority governed developer as well for social housing. But yeah, so we had a research committee. We met for 3 to 4 months. We had expert meetings. Senator Chang was essential in that, not only just on like the idea and policy side, but even into some of the messaging side. This idea of like housing as a public good, just like education is in our country. We definitely borrowed, stealed, whatever you want to say from Senator Chang, but appreciate that. And yeah, we just also talked a lot with Paul Williams with Montgomery County, Maryland. We also actually did heavily rely too on the first draft of AB 2053 from California to kind of pull pieces from that. And we came up with the first draft after a couple of months. We did community feedback meetings, changed a few things here and there, came up with a final draft, went back to different community partners, and then submitted our initiative to the city clerk in Seattle.
Yeah, and through that process, with so much community feedback, expert feedback, we ended up with a policy that we were super proud of that really created social housing that was public in perpetuity with cross-class communities, but also had a lot of other really interesting features. And we just wanted to highlight some of the features that really came to us through this community and expert process. So making all developments mixed use, resident majority board of directors, like Tiffany mentioned. So out of the 13 members on the board, there 7 of them will be residents who are elected by their fellow residents. Having resident governance councils for each building. This came from our allies in California. That we talked to that have this in their bill, a goal that all new developments are using union practices and establishing labor harmony agreements. That was through conversations with labor in our county. Payments for board members was really essential because we have so many people who are representing lived experiences on the board. We wanted to make sure that there was not a big barrier for them being able to serve so that they could properly represent those lived experiences without having to give up work time, childcare time, in order to make that happen. Having a goal of a low barrier application process, this is essential to the Real Change mission. As Tiffany mentioned at the beginning, Real Change is a low barrier employment opportunity for low-income people. And so having low barrier application to housing is also critical. Having the passive house mandate that Tiffany mentioned for those high green standards came through expert meetings. Having the explicit requirement that there not be discrimination based on immigration status and former incarceration came from community meetings, including the robust tenant protections, including restorative justice conflict resolution practices and a total ban on financial eviction came from a group of lawyers who defends people who are being evicted. And then the wide range of incomes with only a very soft cap at the 120% AMI, that was one of the things that Senator Chang was really pushing for, as well as a variety of other people. So having these community feedback processes helped us to get a lot of buy-in and also just a lot of really good policy ideas that made it something that we were super proud to present to the residents of Seattle.
Yeah, and then getting into some of the messaging, we did we had a communications committee. So we, as I said at the beginning, had some staff like myself that were paid that time could totally be dedicated to this. The rest of like our steering committee and our coalition are our volunteers, or they're paid through their orgs, like some unions and the unions or larger, even nonprofit housing developers would have some of their staff help us on these committees and use that staff time for that. So we did a SWOT analysis, a strength, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, because we knew that we're a group that's not taken very seriously, because, you know, for many reasons, but one big one is like, we have a low budget. We are not hiring like consultants to do everything for us. We're doing this in a special election, et cetera, et cetera. So we just did this also, again, as a learning opportunity for folks that are newer to the policy arena or the campaign arena to get into like, what are the opportunities for this initiative? And as Camille touched on earlier, like no one knows what social housing is. There's just throughout the entire thing, it was a massive opportunity for public education, education around what the restrictions are in our current affordable housing scheme and how social housing is able to expand on that, work in tandem with that, but also provide some of these opportunities to renters that are precluded by the federal government under what we currently do. But it was also a chance to get like renters who now make up the majority of the population in the city of Seattle, actually give them a stake in the city in which they live and give them a stake in being able to stay living here if they want to, where right now too many of our neighbors are one rent increase away from being priced out of the city that they want to be in. So just massive education opportunities, and we were able to capitalize on those a lot. And then we also had this proof of concept in Montgomery County, Maryland, which was really, really critical because, I mean, still there are bad faith actors that still think that there's some secret sauce, like that's a verbatim quote, some secret sauce, some like magic unicorn stuff that we're going to try to pull and it will never pencil out. Having Montgomery County, Maryland as an ally and a resource and showing that they've been doing this, even though they don't call it social housing for so long, that was really a critical opportunity to show that this does pencil, it does work, and it's being done. And then for the threats, I mean, as you all know there, or wherever you're calling in from, no one knows what social housing is. If we don't differentiate social housing enough from current affordable housing, people can just call it repetitive or redundant, or that it's just seeking to take more from the small pie that's already put aside. Or there's also a threat of equating social housing with how public housing has been done in the United States in the past, which we all know was an abomination, to put it bluntly, and public housing was failed. It was set up to fail. It didn't fail just on its own volition. And then the threats with, you know, putting forward a really can be complex idea is it can be overly technical and you can get really stuck in the technical weeds, or that there's just like a lack of willingness to understand. And, you know, we're working through some of these bumps in the road that we came up from like our allies in nonprofit housing development, because there is such a scarcity mindset, because it is true the federal government only gives so much money to the low-income housing tax credit or Section 8 vouchers or project-based vouchers. There is a scarcity there, but that's also the beauty of social housing, is you don't have to worry about those scarcity of what the federal government will fund. But trying to convey that to some folks that are currently doing affordable housing and, you know, have spent their lives trying to do this, That was actually a big threat for us, something we had to really overcome here in the city of Seattle.
So looking at those opportunities and threats, we definitely sort of divided our campaign into a few very specific strategies. So I think that the biggest sort of overarching strategy was centering this vision of what Seattle could be. Tiffany mentioned this at the beginning, how we came off of an opposition campaign, you know, and we wanted to go forward and be sort of a positive, you know, finally have like a really exciting yes campaign to work on, where we weren't just fighting against bad policies, but creating something where we could really envision Seattle being a more livable place for everyone in the future. And so no matter what, everything always came back to a positive vision. When things were getting overly technical, when people were criticizing specific parts of the policy or criticizing the idea that we shouldn't give housing to higher income people because they don't have the most need, we were always just bringing it back to the positive vision and making sure, you know, utilizing our experience on Senator Chang's delegation to Vienna, utilizing people who are, you know, living and breathing social housing around the world to show that we don't have to live with an extreme homelessness crisis. We don't have to live with people paying half of their income every month in rent, but there is an alternative to our current system where people can, you know, envision that. So then in order to do sort of the more technical side of things, we were trying to be really, really clear with highlighting the differences between this and other models. And in doing that, also demonstrating how this is a complementary housing model to existing structures. It's not taking away from existing financing models because it, you know, it can't use the low-income housing tax credit. And so just highlighting the differences in the restrictions on federally financed housing, the availability across the income spectrum, availability to immigrants, and just making sure that those differences were highlighted without demonizing the people who are already doing affordable housing. So there's differences, but it's a complementary difference. Another effort that we had to do a lot towards the end of the campaign, when we started to get a little bit more of a formal opposition, was humanizing higher income residents. We had an opposition calling people in the 80 to 120% of the area median income rich renters. And so we had to be really clear, as that 80 to 120% AMI, especially in cities like Seattle and places around the country where there's a large proportion of people who work in tech, that's not rich. That is still extraordinarily rent burdened. And so we had a lot of partnerships with unions, including our local educator union, as well as some healthcare workers, that helped us to really humanize what the need for these higher people on the higher ends of the income spectrum. We had stories from resident physicians who are doing their residencies at the University of Washington Medical Center, and required to live within 15 minutes of the hospital for emergencies. They are, for context, the University of Washington is in one of the most expensive parts of the city to find housing, and residents are not paid well. They wrote op-eds, talked about their experiences of being forced to live in specific neighborhoods, but not being able to afford their housing. And so utilizing those sorts of partnerships, our, you know, educators union also had similar stories. They're not able to recruit people to the teaching academy in Seattle because people don't want to dedicate a career to a place that they know they aren't going to be able to pay their rent. So there's just a lot of opportunities to humanize these higher income renters throughout the campaign. And then the last thing that we really tried to do throughout the campaign was relying on the dozens of international examples and national example of Montgomery County, Maryland, to show what the vision is. And then not only show what the vision is, but using Montgomery County, Maryland, which exists within our, you know, within the United States, which has very specific contextual things that people will criticize, our use of, sometimes the use of Vienna as an example. People will be like, oh, well, it's Europe, so it's a different context. But that's where Montgomery County, Maryland really came in handy to show that even within our federally restricted housing system that we have, there are financing systems that can work for this type of public development of social housing.
So yeah, we wanted to talk a little bit about how we created that buy-in and this large force that did get us to win on a February ballot by 14 points. I mean, you know, this meant for us canvassing, you know, before the holidays in December and then right after the holidays when it's like snowing and raining. So, but even from the beginning, when, you know, I think we raised overall $230,000 for this. How do we get this buy-in? And I know there are lots of efforts happening around the country right now on the inception of coalitions to get buy-in, or at the state level to get buy-in. So we just wanted to share a bit of how we did that here. And just like from the beginning, the community aspect of the drafting was really huge. We also did have some, just working at Real Change, being in the community, we have those relationships and whatnot. But as a coalition and steering committee, being really open about how we're going to communicate this and how we're drafting it. And should we include X over Y? Like, that created a lot of buy-in and ownership over the policy, ownership over social housing, ownership over this vision that we're putting forward. So that was really, really critical in getting like endorsements and also just getting people out canvassing and text banking and calling folks and getting them to turn in their ballots in time. All of those relationships were critical throughout every step of the way for the initiative. For endorsements, because especially when you are a deeply grassroots campaign, when you don't have a lot of money to hire or to just spend in the public sphere on like ads, digital purchases and whatnot, we just really, again, went back to our base and reached out to folks that we knew would give us even honestly some more credibility, as opposed to a bunch of like lefty activists that are putting forward policy. Yeah, you can imagine the things that we heard. But so with electeds, we did a lot of strategic targeting. We did get some really strong state legislators and a county council member here who endorsed us. At the city level, it's actually not permissible for city council members to endorse initiatives. If they are asked how they will vote on an initiative, they can say that, but they can't endorse because they can't use their political office to sway an initiative at the city level. We actually also had a lot of pushback from local electeds, folks that you just like really wouldn't imagine would be against this were. So we had to, you know, broaden out a little bit more, but specifically go after like folks who claim to be housing champions and ask them to get behind this. It was also really key for us to get service providers. So what we mean by that are current nonprofit developers. I don't know what the equivalent would be in Hawaii, but here in King County, we have the Housing Development Consortium, which is like dozens of different nonprofit developers, for-profit developers, banks, et cetera, that do housing construction. And they came out in opposition quite early on, concerned about not receiving the housing levy, concerned about us duplicating efforts, concerned about us taking our eye off the ball of what's currently happening. So that again gets into like that communication piece that Camille really stressed. You know, we had to decide like this wasn't ever about bashing what we're currently doing. Like, folks are doing the best they can with the market tools that they've been given. But there is this other option. There is this other model out in the world that is working every day. There's no reason we can't bring it here to the United States. So we were really focused on getting some current nonprofit developers to endorse this effort and see it not as in competition, but we should be working together against the private market. So we got a few of those folks who were members of the Housing Development Consortium, some more on the smaller scale, some on the larger scale, that came out and really helped to legitimize this idea that social housing is A, different, but also B, completely necessary. And having current service providers was also key because they know that there is such a thing as a benefits cliff, for instance. And we know that at Real Change, we know that vendors do not take certain jobs because they're worried about losing their SNAP benefits or their housing voucher. We have staff at Real Change who have been unhoused in the past that work a set amount of hours so they don't lose that prized voucher. So service providers know that their populations would benefit from not having to like go from some sort of a safety net completely just onto the private market. So that helped also to legitimize the need for social housing. And then getting endorsements from labor. This was really a rank and file strategy. A lot of the, you know, politicos, if you will, at the top, so like staff members of some of our labor unions weren't as inclined to support this. It really took like the rank and file of the entire county to overwhelmingly pass the endorsement. We had some unions here and there, specifically those that work with like folks that are in like our low income service sector jobs who got on board really, really quickly. But yeah, it's super important to get labor involved and to get them supporting. And then we also, you know, created an expectation of our endorsers to take an active role. So we have monthly coalition meetings where we, you know, report back from the campaign, the day-to-day, what's happening, what new endorsements we've received, what kind of like challenging areas we're navigating and getting feedback on that. And then it was also just regular communication with action items. And I mean, these are still things we're doing now during implementation. I mean, we just have been sending out action alerts because, you know, any renter in the city of Seattle, or even if you just work in the city of Seattle, is able to serve on the board. So that's happening now, but it's just us being like that consistent voice, pushing this forward, getting endorsements, building the coalition, and just getting that buy-in for a different vision of the city.
Yeah, so just to kind of wrap up the presentation part, and then I know that we'll definitely leave some good time for questions and discussion, but just to kind of tie all of that into where we're at now. So as of our election day was February 14th, we were winning on election night, which we didn't necessarily know to expect, but we ended up winning by, as Tiffany mentioned, a 14-point margin. That was certified on March 1st, which started a clock to get the implementation phase out, up and running. It has been a really fast process. We wrote that into the initiative intentionally because we didn't want it to stall out. But we are currently working on the board appointment. So as we mentioned, there's a 13-member board. All 13 members are appointed by a variety. I think there's 6 different appointing entities for the 13 members. So coordinating those are things that we're continuing to advocate for. And all of those appointments have to be made by April 25th. So less than a month from now to get all of those appointments done. As far as funding, we're in the short term looking at operations funding. So we mandated in the initiative that the city is required to give 18 months of startup support, including in-kind and funding support for staff members. So that's something that we're actively working on and running into some legal hiccups that we didn't anticipate upon, you know, during the drafting phase. But now that it is in the city's hands, there are some legal hiccups. So we're potentially not going to get all of the money as quickly as we were hoping to get it for the developer. So there's just been a lot of continuing advocacy around making sure that the developer is really supported, that the board members, once they are appointed, are supported legally and financially. And then in the medium to long term, of course, we are going to be looking at a variety of ways to get capital funding for the developer to start actually developing and purchasing buildings. So that is an effort that we will likely do possibly through another initiative process to get a progressive revenue source for it. And then also working with the city council and state to get funding at those levels. And we're continuing through all of this, we're continuing our relationship building. So we're still partnering with unions and organizations. We have efforts that we want to work with the building trades unions and the labor council here to get apprenticeships so that union laborers are able to build to passive house standards. Mentioned that partnering with service providers and legislators to get the funding that we're talking about and to just really make sure that this is super supported. So getting the initiative passed was very much step one in what we are, you know, recognizing as a multi-year process. So we are through step one, and now implementation is going to be several years, and we're going to be with it every step of the way, making sure that the people who are running the developer and, you know, legislating for our city and state are supporting it so that we can have a successful social housing developer here in Seattle. That's our presentation. I'm going to stop sharing so that we can, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for that presentation. Certainly gave us a lot of really useful information, and it's wonderful hearing about how the initiative moved through. And I'm going to admit, I actually didn't know all about the role that Senator Chang played in sort of communicating with all of you. So perhaps he's being a little too humble on that one, because I hadn't heard that story until you'd shared it. Well, we only have one question shared so far from our attendees. I think you did address it, but I don't think we can ask that question too much. But before I ask it, I do want to encourage anyone else who has joined us to share your question. We have about 17 minutes left on the clock, and we want to get through as many of those as possible. But the first question we received was from Kevin, and he asked, how do you define social housing? You did give definitions multiple times, but again, I think social housing is a concept that's still really new to a lot of people, even people in the housing space, even people who attend discussions like the one we're in today. So let's hear some of your favorite definitions of social housing from a communication standpoint. Whichever one of you wants to take that one.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a really solid question. And I mean, Camille and I over like these last 19 months always are like, it's like every month coming back with like, this is, we can get it even tighter. Like, let's get it to be this way. But you know, just like, I think that the most important things about social housing, especially in the context of the United States, just so folks are able to differentiate it from what we currently do is that it's decom modified housing. There is no profit motive whatsoever for this. It's not about like increasing rents to market rate in order to, you know, buy more yachts or buy more properties for you and your family. It's about housing as a public good, as Senator Chang calls it. And it is in public hands in perpetuity and permanently affordable. So just for folks to know how we currently do affordable housing in the United States, there is no requirement, maybe in some parts of the country, but not in Washington State, there's no requirement for affordable housing developers to keep the housing in public hands forever. And Camille has actually researched a lot of examples in the city of Seattle, specifically around Hope 6, where folks after that low-income housing tax credit runs out actually end up selling the properties because they're not able to maintain the operations and maintenance of the building anymore with the income of the population they were able to serve. So we're really just setting up like our affordable housing mechanisms to not be public in perpetuity and not be permanently affordable. So those are like three of the, and creating cross-class communities, I'd say those are like four of the big things. Because in public housing in the past in the United States, it was really about segregating out Black, Brown, low-income communities away from everyone else. And social housing is like the antithesis of that. What was really cool about going to Vienna and hearing from Wiener Wohnen, which is their municipal housing developer, is they really see buildings there as income blind. You it doesn't matter what your income is, you just all live in the same place. And this idea that if you make a little bit more money, you're then kicked out of that housing is just like a completely unnatural concept to them. So yeah, I would say, yeah, decommodified, publicly owned in perpetuity, permanently affordable, and creating cross-class communities. Camille, would you agree?
We have a few other questions, but yeah, I was going to ask Camille to also jump in if she wanted to add on.
No, I think that Tiffany did a great job. I think I've also heard Senator Chang use the term income blind, but just the idea that housing affordability is not just for very wealthy people who can afford really whatever they want. And it's also not just for extremely low income people. There's the idea within sort of like the housing study space that there's dualist housing systems where you have the market and then nonprofits to provide for extremely low income, very specific portions that are just completely not served by the market. And then if you can technically make enough money to afford the market, but maybe not affordably, then you're just, you know, screwed. And then there's the integrated systems where the public and the private are all in one place because anyone can go to either side and it makes housing more affordable on both the private and the public market. And so I think that, yeah, this idea of being available to everyone in an income blind way is absolutely crucial.
Well, I want to build on that point. I believe on slide 5, there was something referred to as a soft cap. So are the homes under the current proposed model that that you folks are looking at, are they truly affordable to everyone, including the very rich, those above 120% AMI, for example?
Yeah, we have it written in there too that rent should not be more than 30% of your income. I mean, it would be nice if we would get more like Vienna and have it be even less than that of your income every month. But, you know, we wanted to start somewhere. So we have in there not more than 30%. But the soft cap really is like, again, getting into this idea of you're not going to be financially evicted if you make 121% of the area median income. Like, this is your home. You can stay in there. You'll pay a little bit more rent. But we just wanted to prioritize in the developer those four income brackets between 0 to 120. So that's why it's written in there that way.
Great. Well, shifting gears a little bit, what role, if any, does land use and zoning reform play in the creation of social housing?
Yeah, it's essential. If I can, like, I think Camille and I both went on a journey of learning about like NIMBY and YIMBY and FIMBY and all these other terms. And I'm not ashamed at all to say that. So just like learning those, but we're very honest. Like, we've been honest throughout the entire campaign too. This is about public education. Just creating a social housing developer is not going to get us to a social housing, you know, utopia or even like a social housing reality, because the history of redlining and keeping out Black and Brown communities in certain areas of the city of Seattle, the fact that most of Seattle is still zoned only for single family homes in the middle of like a climate, a homelessness and a housing crisis is utterly absurd. We need to do all that we can in order to house everyone. So they go hand in hand, and we're actually working on our updated comprehensive plan at the city level. And we're advocating for, another alternative to upzone the entire city. So these things have to happen in tandem.
Great. Well, thank you to Christian for including that question. Camille, did you want to add anything to that before we move to the next one? Okay. I think a good one to shift gears to is a question related from Jason about opportunities to expand this to the county and state levels. Jason highlighted those immediate obvious barriers to growing social housing. Are there, or can the Seattle play be duplicated? Do you see this as scalable out to other neighboring counties? Maybe let's just maybe focus on like the western half of the United States, as there's a little bit more similarity there. Could this be done on those state levels or in other counties as a plug and play in that way?
I can start from like a sort of more logistical lens to it. I think that it is definitely possible. You know, we see states working towards this. Hawaii and California and places on the East Coast as well are working towards statewide efforts. It obviously will look quite different. It's probably not developing a singular developer. You know, maybe if it's a small enough state, that's the case. But within Washington, we were just on a call earlier today with some folks in Eastern Washington, which for context is quite different from Seattle. The Western side of the state and Eastern side of the state are very, very different places. The Eastern Washington is very rural, tends a lot more conservative politically as well. But there's also just a lot of income differences, and we're talking about potential state efforts and funding later on for the types of efforts that they're doing in this Eastern Washington town and our own, which there's a lot of similarities, but then there's also a lot of differences. There's not as much rentership in these places. There's, you know, the populations are much smaller, so there's a much heavier focus on home ownership. And so I think that having it be more municipally focused is important in our context, just given the huge differences across the state. But we do know that there are people in other cities that want to replicate what we've done. We've talked to Tacoma, which is one of our other large cities in the state, who's interested in doing something. One of our direct suburbs is also interested in doing something similar, and their council is actually interested in potentially just doing it the legislative route. But I do think that like a state level effort could happen. I don't know if it would happen through legislation, just knowing our state legislators here. But I think it is definitely replicable. I don't know if you have anything to add, Tiffany.
No, it's replicable. It's just that give and take. Do you have the initiative system in your state? Do you have the ability to start up this coalition? So there, yeah, it's just give and take. So if you do it through the state legislative route, you're not going to like have everything that we included in the initiative, but you're going to have, you know, the state behind it and that local government buy-in and potentially funding right out the gate. Like, there's just give and take with every approach. The exciting thing is there's a lot of people across the entire country trying it. That's what's the most important.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the information and letting us know. So it sounds like this is just the beginning of a lot of grassroots organizing around this issue, far from the end. Kevin asks you to please expand on the financing, as in who is issuing the bonds and are they backed by the state, et cetera. Would I be right to understand that this would be like municipal, like city or county bonds?
Yeah. So the bonding component of this, so the Public Development Authority itself, the Seattle Social Housing Developer, has bonding authority on its own. So it will be able to issue its own bonds. Ideally, and what we will be working on with the council is to get city-backed bonds, because the city of Seattle has AAA rating for bonds. And so having that type of access is critical. And there's precedent to show that the city of Seattle does issue bonds for public development authorities within its premises. So that is the idea. On its own, the Public Development Authority as a public entity can issue bonds. It's just more ideal when there's the partnership with the city because of their long history and track record of, you know, being good on their word, paying back their debts. And so that is the ideal situation. But we know that there's a lot of proof to show that the type of development that we're proposing, the cross-class, mixed income, social housing development, even without the city's AAA-backed rating, there's a lot of proof to show that the developer on its own will be able to pay back its debts.
All right. Thank you very much for the information. Something a little bit similar. Anonymous asked, what mechanisms, but also I want to ask, are there mechanisms available for developers to purchase or renovate already operational housing, or is this only for new housing?
We wrote in the initiative to acquire or to build. So we totally need to be able to, purchase properties that are already out there. Maybe that's affordable housing developers that, you know, aren't able to keep something going after like the low-income housing tax credit runs out, or if it's off of the private market. I mean, just really, really briefly, because I know we're running out of time, but if anyone just wants to Google the Madkin, MADKIN apartments here in Seattle, it's a community of folks that have lived in the building for 5 to 40 years. The owner died, the land that the apartment building passed to his family member. She didn't want to, you know, take it over and put it on the private market. The tenants organized, they tried to get a nonprofit to buy it. They tried to get the city to buy it. Some of these people have been living in this building from 20, 30 to 40 years. They have an entire community put together, but now it's been sold off on the private market. If we had the social housing developer at that time, we could have went in and bought that, kept that community together that's already fighting to stay together, and not potentially displace these residents who are paying below market rent out of the city. So that's the idea. And that's what we imagine in the first couple of years will be the bulk of the portfolio building is around acquiring and bringing those into the social housing developer.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, I think we only have time for one more question. So quite appropriately, I saved one of the longer questions for this, but let's see if we can get through it. Thomas asked, how do social housing advocates reduce resistance from all entities who are not only used to building all housing for profit, but also think it's impossible to build enough housing on a nonprofit basis, and then keeping that perpetually affordable? I think that's maybe a topic for a whole new discussion later, but if you have any initial thoughts on that, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, You know, I think that there's a couple of ways to answer this, and I totally agree about like the length. This could be a long conversation, but I'm really going to pick up on this reducing resistance from entities. You know, this is also a reason we went the way that we did, is we didn't want to have to, you know, like battle with entities right out the gate over definitions or over what they thought we could do or what we couldn't. Honestly, if we had done that and we tried to go through current affordable housing spheres, we would have not gotten very far because a lot of them still don't think that social housing is any different. So what we focused on, we're talking to renters and talking to folks that are being priced out of the city or work in the city but can't afford to live here anymore. And when you start talking to those people who day to day live with this question of how much money do I need to be able to stay in the city of Seattle, it's super easy to get them on board with social housing. Like, it took no effort to persuade renters. Like, the idea of a renter knowing that they'll be here for 5 to 10 years is like unfathomable in the city. So we spent a tremendous amount of time talking to voters that, you know, if we had hired a consultant, would have said, don't spend your time on those folks. They're not going to vote. But they did vote because we put forward something that they were excited about voting for. So when it gets to the entities that say this can't be done, this can't be done, just know that if you look outside of the boundary of our country, this is happening every day, like in Uruguay, in Toronto, in Vienna, in Singapore, et cetera. This does happen. It can happen. It's not happening because there's not will to do it. So we as like the citizens and the people have to make that happen. And you're fortunate in Hawaii to have, you know, Senator Chang and others that we went with on the delegation that are wanting to push this forward because they know, and we all know, that what we're doing is never going to meet the scale of our need.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the information. Really mahalo to Camille and Tiffany for being here, for sharing more of your story and letting us know how Seattle passed social housing. Very informative to me. I think it really highlights a lot of the potential for this as a movement. So I appreciate all that. I also want to mahalo our attendees for being here and for sharing your insightful questions. Please be on the lookout for more information about our next Our Homes webinar. And until next time, aloha.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.